Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Dexter Fergie, your host for today's episode of New Books in American Studies. Today I'll be joined by Andrew Needham, Associate Professor of History at New York University. We'll be speaking about his not entirely new, but still very exceptional book called Power Lines, Phoenix and the Making of the Modern Southwest. It was published by Princeton University Press in hardcover in 2014 and in paperback in 2016. Power Lines tells a complicated but important story about the politics of energy systems. Needham looks at the making of the Southwest in the 20th century, focusing especially on the vast and complex infrastructure that linked urban spaces to the hinterlands. He shows that the rapid development of Phoenix and other Southwest cities depended on massive quantities of cheap energy, and that energy, primarily coal, came from and polluted Navajo lands. Stories about infrastructure are sometimes hard to read. Needham, however, skillfully tells a dramatic story that should help us rethink spatial relationships, the inequalities of our energy systems, and modernity. The book brings together many different fields and would therefore be of interest to a broad audience, including environmental historians, political historians, Native American historians, and urban historians. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Andrew Needham about his fascinating new book called Power Lines. Thanks a lot for taking the time to speak with me, Andrew.
My pleasure.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book, as I've already told you when we're offline, and I've been really looking forward to talking to you about it. As you probably know on this show, we'd like to begin with a pretty broad question about how you became a scholar. How did you become a historian?
So I really became an environmental historian in the years in between kind of finishing my undergraduate degree and starting graduate school. So I moved to San Francisco after I finished my undergraduate degree with not a real clear idea of what I wanted to do. And I ended up working at a place called the Whole Earth Catalog, which is most famous for producing in 1970, the Whole Earth, or 69, the Whole Earth Catalog, this kind of journal of tools and ideas. When I was there in the mid 90s, they were producing what they called the Millennium Whole Earth Catalog, which was an update of the catalog for the year, meant for the year 2000. They're doing it kind of in the mid 90s. One of the jobs I had there was assigning book reviews, and we would get an eclectic mix of books that kind of straddled the line between kind of scholarship and journalism. And the book that came in that was most influential on me was Rebecca Solnit's book Savage Wars, which kind of tells the story of kind of the remaking of landscapes across the American West, focusing on Yosemite in the 19th century and the atomic test sites in Nevada in the mid 20th century. And kind of reading it, this was a kind of history. I was a history major as an undergrad, but this was a kind of history that I had never really even considered, the way that human action and human interest transformed landscape in, you know, in really powerful and unequal ways. Because one of the subtexts of that book is the way that indigenous people and their land claims are really subordinated to the interests of dominant societies for wilderness, for nuclear testing, for other things. And so, you know, going from, you know, when I started graduate school, kind of those, that set of interests was really kind of embedded in me as, you know, as one of the real core questions I wanted to ask. And I think, you know, a lot of it was, you know, experiencing the American West in my, you know, in my mid-20s, and, you know, and seeing it as a, you know, as a very different landscape, which is a very kind of stereotypical kind of, you know, Western story, the naive person from the Midwest goes to the West and is shocked by, you know, by the difference that he, you know, he, it's usually a he, confronts. But, you know, it, you know, despite the kind of, you know, the stereotypical nature of that story, it, you know, it really was kind of deeply influential in the kind of historical questions that I found myself asking kind of throughout my career. Like, how did this, you know, how did this place come to be used and developed in this way? How has it changed environments, and who has benefited, and who is and who has not benefited from those changes?
Great. So how did you come to this specific project, this project about the Southwest and Phoenix, Arizona in particular?
There's really kind of two stories there. One is a, you know, story of, you know, driving past Four Corners Power Plant and kind of seeing its plume for kind of miles and miles and miles. When I was, you know, when I was on my way to go to the San Juan Mountains and seeing that plume and being kind of shocked and appalled that, you know, what is this, you know, what is this, what is this thing doing here, right? It did not seem to kind of match my ideas of the kind of, economic life or the kind of industry that belong kind of so far from urban spaces. And so that kind of, you know, that happened in this period that I was talking about earlier. And so this was before I began graduate school, but that idea of like, what is this doing here, stayed with me, you know, just as a kind of useful, productive question. And then when I was in my first year of graduate school at the University of Michigan, I had to do a first year seminar paper. And the graduate library there happened to have, I mean, I was interested in these questions that I kind of talked about before, landscape change and environment in the American West. And so that had brought me to look at kind of tourism as one of the primary ways that kind of landscape, you know, change became an economic kind of, you know, that unique landscapes became a kind of an economic driver. The University of Michigan happened to have a 80-year run of a magazine called Arizona Highways, which has this very, in the way that in a first year seminar paper, you're kind of grasping for whatever sources you can find. And so because there was this big run of the magazine that was a monthly magazine, I sat down and literally, I didn't read every article, but I did, you know, enter every article into a database and kind of read through 80 years of this magazine and saw it go through this transition from in the late teens, early 20s, you know, really promoting the idea of building roads in Arizona. We need roads in order that this state can become modern, to a shift in the mid-30s toward promoting the kind of unique qualities of the state, most prominent among them, the state's native peoples, which, you know, in the early part of the magazine are completely sidelined, but then starting in the 30s, come to feature this very prominent role as a, you know, as a counterpoint to modernity and what makes Arizona unique and special. So come to Arizona. As the phrasing in the magazine almost always went, you know, come to Arizona, drive north, and see people living as they lived, you know, 30, 40, 50, 100, 200 years ago. Driving into northern Arizona is a way to drive into the past. And so kind of that, you know, thinking about, oh, how does this power plant that is kind of sitting in the back of my mind fit into these stories of kind of temporal dislocation, became the kind of germ of, you know, of the book itself. And then, you know, I went and, you know, began investigating the history of that power plant and literally followed its power lines back to Phoenix, which was the main source of consumption for the electricity generated there. And so that really began to lead me to see connections between kind of the native landscape of northern Arizona, western New Mexico, and this, you know, exploding city that grows from, you know, across the second half of the 20th century, grows from about 100,000 people to a couple million people.
Wonderful. I feel like there could be a third story as well. So at the University of Michigan, your advisor was Matthew Lassiter, correct?
Actually, my advisor was Maria Montoya.
Really? Oh, okay. That's really interesting. But I mean, there's a really big suburban element to your story. And I've recently been going through Lily Geismer's book, and then as well Connolly's book, and there just seems to be like a generation of scholars coming out of the University of Michigan who are doing just really cool suburban histories.
Yeah, no, that was one of these wonderful idiosyncratic moments, mm-hmm. right? Of that I happened to be at Michigan at a moment when, you know, kind of because of Matt Lassiter, because of Jesse Hoffman Garskoff, because of some other people, a bunch of graduate students really began to work around these questions of what are the boundaries of the city in post-war America? What are the effects of suburbanization, metropolitanization? And you know, Matt ran a couple of different seminars where he brought kind of numerous people in. To run through projects, you know, at various stages in their development, either after their book is out or, you know, as they're working on it. So that gave me, you know, an opportunity to really not only read deeply in that literature, but to be in a group of, you know, people like, you know, like Lily, like Nathan, like Andrew Highsmith, Clay Howard, who are all kind of working kind of, you know, in different ways kind of around, you know, around these issues. And I always saw my project as, you know, from the time I was writing updates to, well, here's what I accomplished this year of bringing together the ideas in Bill Kernan's Nature's Metropolis, about the kind of the broad reach of urban economic life, and Tom Segrew's Origins of the Urban Crisis, saying kind of here's the way that kind of urban transformation produces inequality. And so, you know, one of the things that, you know, I was able to do thinking with these people was to think about, well, what does the map of inequality look like if we broaden the borders of metropolitan life to include its resource demands. And you know, I think that so bringing those questions of growth and inequality together with questions of basically how does a modern city sustain itself, you know, led me to kind of these new, you know, to a, I think, new map of inequality in post-war America, or at least in the Southwest.
Great. You've anticipated my first question about the inside of your book. So we'll finally enter it now. So your book charts the 20th century history of the Southwest and shows how energy systems involving dams, coal, electrical power lines connected this region in deeply unequal ways. So, you know, for instance, the cheap energy from the Navajo lands fueled the rapid post-war development of metropolitan spaces like Phoenix. And so as you've been alluding to so far, geography plays a huge role in framing and advancing your argument. So you write, and I think you actually just quoted it in your last answer, that your book constructs a broad new map of post-war urban, environmental, and political change. And so this regional approach that links both urban and suburban spaces with the hinterlands sort of challenges some of the recent historiography on suburbs and the cities. And so those works seem to cut off the suburbs from anything beyond it. And that almost reifies these older assumptions about how it was the city and like the metropole that was the engine of growth, and it therefore conceals some of the very real contributions to development from the country. So could you just elaborate on this regional approach and maybe tell our listeners what is gained by using this much broader geographic framework?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, it's funnily one of the places it comes from is really, you know, if you think of, you know, if you think geography, you think maps, right? And one of the places that the geography that I write about in this book comes from is really kind of archival discoveries of maps of power lines that, you know, progressively show kind of how deeply interconnected the Southwest's growing urban cities and its hinterlands become, you know, from really the starting in the 50s, but really it's starting to really take off in the 60s and 70s. So the maps that I found initially showed kind of direct connections between power plants on direct connections between local power plants and local consumers. So power plants located, you know, in the Phoenix metropolitan area. Then starting around 1961, new connections between Phoenix and Four Corners Power Plant located near the Four Corners, about, you know, 40 miles south of the actual Four Corners. But then in doing research in the Bureau of Reclamation, I found a report in 1970 from the Department of Energy that has this amazing schematic power map that shows a series of power plants, four power plants that really ring the Navajo Nation, and cities throughout the Southwest. So, you know, with that map, with the interconnection of multiple power plants and multiple cities, and this is not also, it's not only Phoenix, but also Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Albuquerque, Salt Lake City. You know, there's on the corner of the map, it says to Denver. There's this picture of this, you know, increasingly dense connection between the energy supplies of coal located on native land and urban and suburban consumers located hundreds of miles away. And I think, you know, the merits of this approach, you know, really allow us to understand, as you suggested, the ways that the cities and city and suburban borders as we normally consider them, in a way hide the broad effects, the broad transformative effects that contemporary urban and suburban life have had on kind of landscapes far away. And I mean, this is a, you know, I think this is a history that if you were to take it to a national scale, you could include stories like the creation of water supplies, New York's water supplies in first Westchester County and then the Catskills. It could be used to think about urban waste disposal and where kind of urban waste goes. So these kind of cascading effects that are both kind of environmental and political, that that urban resource demands really have, take stories of inequality away from what Robert Self called this classic story, right, of the of Black inner city surrounded by a white suburban noose, and you know, remap inequality to kind of show another kind of layer beyond beyond suburbs that are kind of, you know, where kind of unequal relations that are both political and ecological become put in place.
One thing that your book does really well is provide like a coherent narrative for infrastructure, which is a subject that is like a really hard thing to do, you know, because of its vastness, its complexity, and when it's functioning, its invisibility. So these are problems that I face in my own research and writing. And so I was wondering if you could just say something about the task of infrastructure history and how exactly you tackle it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that you're right that infrastructure is invisible in its experience. But one of the actual great things about studying infrastructure as a historian is that there is clear physical evidence of its, you know, of its presence in many ways. I mean, one of the things I do early on in the book is kind of basically kind of narrate a power line's reach from Phoenix up to Four Corners Power Plant. And the way I was actually able to do that was using Google Earth and zoomed in fairly, you know, fairly close, was able to actually follow, you know, one of these extra high voltage power lines as it makes its way across Arizona's landscape. So while, you know, the consumption of electricity becomes, I mean, in many ways, second nature in Phoenix, in the wonderful dual meaning that Bill Cronin's use of second nature has, the actual physical presence of infrastructure allows, you know, and the understanding that this infrastructure is built at a particular moment for a particular set of interests, allows historians to, you know, to really bring kind of time and space together in a profound way to kind of escape that old kind of, you know, accusation that historians write as if history took place on the head of a pin, while also kind of getting away from the, you know, the geographer's, you know, sense of kind of timelessness. So, I think that infrastructure in its, you know, in its both its invisibility and its visibility is this kind of wonderful tool to think about how has political power worked. And, you know, this is my book obviously has kind of, you know, power has dual meanings, right? Power is electricity and what it enables people to do in kind of modern lives, but it also is, you know, power in the ability of people in certain places to claim use of resources from another place for their own for their own ends.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. That's actually really interesting that you use Google Earth to look at the power lines, because, you know, like, that's obviously, like, you know, our infrastructure today, that's, like, you know, enabling you to monitor the infrastructure that was built in the past. So that's really neat. And so just another question to kind of set us up. Your book explores the history of a place that does not have the same familiarity as a place like, say, New York or Chicago. And so could you just, like, set the scene for us? What was Phoenix, Arizona, or Arizona more broadly, like in, like, the 1920s and 30s? And maybe you could introduce us to some of the characters that are important to your narrative.
Sure, sure. And I think it's, you know, I think there's, you know, there's two places. I mean, there's two prominent places in this book that are unfamiliar to people, or maybe whose familiarity is, you know, exists as archetype rather than reality, which is probably true of most places, but it's both Phoenix, and the Navajo Nation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Phoenix at the beginning of the book is really a, you know, small agricultural city. And it's strange to think of Phoenix as an agricultural city, because we think of, you know, this city as a prominent kind of desert city. But the story of, you know, Phoenix really in the late 19th and the first half of the 20th century is the success of hydraulic reclamation in transforming desert lands, which have over, you know, tens of thousands of years received, you know, seasonal flooding, which has displaced a lot of really rich soil, you know, into this giant basin of the Salt River Valley, and applying water to that really, you know, did allow as kind of irrigation evangelists in the early 20th century said, you know, made the desert bloom. And Phoenix becomes one of the nation's largest suppliers of citrus, of vegetables, of cotton. You know, in the first half of the 20th century, and Phoenix exists at the center of this larger agricultural landscape as a kind of you know, marketing center. And, you know, services center. There's virtually no manufacturing in Phoenix. The largest manufacturer is both the two industries are agricultural canning, which makes sense, and broom manufacture. And that like broom manufacture is your big industry shows, I think, the kind of the way that, you know, this is not, you know, the, you know, by no means an industrial city. At the same time, the Navajo Nation, at this moment in time, the Navajo people really, I think, are, you know, in the late 19th century, one of the great kind of post-conquest success stories. I mean, that they can be considered a success story, I think, suggests the devastations of you know, American colonialism. But, you know, the Navajo people see a kind of increase in population following their return from forced exile in New Mexico. It's actually the 150th anniversary this year of the signing of the treaty between the Navajo people and the U.S. government. So in 1868, a very small number of Navajo people, 7,000, returned from their forced exile at the Bosque Redondo. And over the next 50 to 60 years, see a kind of resurgence of both human population and animal population as they, you know, really repopulate the Colorado Plateau, which sits in kind of northern Arizona. That, you know, they dramatically kind of increase the territory of their reservation by ignoring government, you know, ignoring boundaries that are, you know, kind of abstract and set in place for no real reason. And, you know, come to claim much of the northern part of the state and the western part of New Mexico. Beginning in the kind of teens, 20s, and 30s, extended drought, and then a program of the U.S. government to forcibly reduce Navajo stock herds devastates the Navajo economy. So, you know, at the time my book really starts, the kind of Navajo people have seen both ecological disaster and a kind of almost a reconquest, a reimposition of American colonial power over them in kind of, you know, removing their subsistence base. So, you know, it's a real moment of kind of profound kind of both economic shock and kind of spiritual, cultural trauma for people who have seen stock herds that they rely on for their lives, you know, killed, in many cases killed in front of them by agents of the U.S. government.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the 1940s and sort of like the post-World War II moment. Like Phoenix itself, its population grew, as you say, from 65,000 to 440,000 between 1940 and 1960. And so it's undergoing tremendous change. They begin to market, like the Chamber of Commerce begins to market it as the Valley of the Sun, where, you know, residents could enjoy outdoor living. But aside from just being an ideal, this was also a political project launched by Phoenician elites. Can you briefly just say something about this political project, and then especially the significance of electricity to that project?
Sure. That's it. The people involved in this project. So Phoenix grows like many cities in the West, beginning with World War II. They becomes a prominent place for training aviators, where you can grow cotton, you can grow pilots, is one of the phrases people use. And also it becomes a site because of the environmental conditions there, low humidity, in particular, becomes a place to manufacture aeronautical aviation components. And, you know, its proximity to Los Angeles allows a lot of, you know, kind of subcontractors to locate in Phoenix and then, you know, ship parts to LA where they will be assembled into military and then civilian aircraft. That growth begins to, as it continues after World War II, frightens people in Phoenix, a kind of new generation of elites that have kind of replaced what I describe as a downtown elite that includes, and most prominently, Barry Goldwater, who owns with his brother a local department store chain, but also a set of bankers, lawyers, who kind of together see a very different future for Phoenix than its agricultural past. I think they consciously also see an opportunity of posing Phoenix as an alternative to, they certainly see it consciously as an alternative to kind of Eastern industrial cities, but also as a space of kind of relief from the New Deal state. In many ways, I think the fact that American industry in the early part of the 20th century grows in states means that those, like New York, Illinois, Michigan, means that those states develop kind of large-scale kind of social service networks, both at the state and both at the state level, as well as the federal level. Arizona, other states in the South don't develop that. And these boosters really see an opportunity to present to capital a kind of relief from you know, labor, from state regulation, from tax burdens. And they very aggressively both work at the state level to remove as many labor rights and rights for union organizing as they can, and you know, work to create state policies that favor labor, and both state and local, including kind of tax abatements, long-term leases offered to particular companies to incentivize them to relocate to Phoenix. So I think in many ways, a lot of the economic program of what we think of as the contemporary New Right really begins in places like Phoenix that seek to attract capital to them using these strategies that kind of work in opposition to the New Deal state beginning I think the late 1940s and moving forward really aggressively into the into the 50s and 60s, and seeing a lot of success in those years, where the I think that the amount of income from manufacturing in Phoenix moves from kind of about $5 million annually in 1950 to $300 million annually by 1960. So a really dramatic increase.
Yeah, we won't have time to go into it too much, but your book also shows just how indebted Phoenix was to the New Deal state, especially in relation to the primary and secondary mortgage markets, which just basically enabled the development of Phoenix. And it was actually the first time that I finally understood why, like basically what were the primary and secondary mortgage market and why they really mattered to suburbanization. But I will leave that to our listeners to look into your book to read.
And that, I mean, that was really one of the fun stories. That was one of the, like, not fun stories, but that was really, I think, one of the things that I also began to understand in the process of doing the research for the book, and how tightly connected these things we think of as abstract, like the secondary mortgage market, were to particular people in this new kind of community of downtown elites in Phoenix, that they are really kind of working very intimately to help create and profit off of both of these mortgage markets.
Yeah. Can you just say a little bit about electricity in the immediate post-war period as a function of attracting all these high-tech businesses and industries, and also like just the massive population boom, electricity demand was increasing. And then there were actually changes to the electrical network and the electrical utilities in Arizona.
Sure. Yeah. No. I think that's obviously a key kind of story that I tell. And I think in the broadest picture, I think historians have not understood enough how kind of central energy is, and the availability of cheap, ready energy is for creating kind of not only modern economic life, but the assumption of growth, that the assumption that energy will be available and will be kind of inexpensive has been one of the major major assumptions of a kind of growth economy as we've known it over the past century, really. So when people think of the Southwest, they usually think about Hoover Dam and the various dams built on the Colorado River. And, you know, indeed, those are, you know, built, you know, in part to supply electricity to the Southwest. But very, very quickly after their construction, as early as 1952, the Bureau of Reclamation, the federal agency that builds dams, realizes that no matter how much hydropower they're able to build, and they're not able to build as much as they want, that demand for electricity will quickly outstrip the supply that's available. So they propose, and Phoenix Utilities propose, kind of simultaneously, though not in concert, that coal will need to be the new primary source of electric generation, you know, for not only Phoenix, but for the West at large. In 1950, coal produces a minuscule amount of electricity in the West, something on the range of 5%. But as early as 1952, the Bureau of Reclamation is saying that, by the year 1970, it will produce 40% of the electric power. It actually ends up producing, by 1980, around 65% of the region's power. So it's not only a story of kind of electrical generation, but where does, you know, what will the source of electricity be? And the choice of coal really directs both federal authorities and private utilities toward coal supplies located on native lands, starting in the 1950s.
Yeah, and that brings us to one of my favorite chapters, chapter 4, called Modernizing the Navajo. And so here you show some of the story that you were just sharing with us about how coal on the Navajo reservation appeared to be a solution to the inadequate supply of energy in metropolitan spaces in the Southwest, but then also to the economic problems that the Navajo were facing. So, you know, you have Phoenician business elites and then also, you know, different levels of government involving themselves, and all of them had different ideas about how the energy system should be built. And then the Navajo tribal leaders had their own vision for how or what that network should look like. Can you just tell us about the different conflicting visions for the use of energy resources and how it eventually shaped the electrical network?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and one of the things that actually really surprised me as I did the research around the book. I mean, Barry Goldwater says writes a letter to Arizona's governor Howard Pyle just after he's elected to the Senate, and says something to the effect of, you know, in mineral resources alone we have enough supply to solve all of our so-called Indian problems. In part, this is a story of, you know, these kind of Phoenix elites saying that we need to kind of take back control of the resources of our state, you know, from kind of federal authority. And in doing so, we can create benefit not only for Phoenix, we can not only produce, you know, the energy that our growth demands, but we can also benefit the native people of the state. In part, they see, you know, what this will require is removing, eliminating the federal trust responsibility for native people. So basically, saying that kind of the federal government will no longer have oversight, such that Indian resources can then be brought into the market at a much more rapid pace. This is a story that I think continues to be a key element of the right's understanding of kind of native underdevelopment, that kind of federal authority prevents the market from working its magic and, you know, rapidly modernizing these economies. For Navajo leaders, they're somewhat sympathetic to this view. I mean, they have a long history of dealing in very contentious ways with the federal government, and the federal government, you know, underserving them systematically. So the idea of having, you know, energy development on their land as a first step toward what they imagine as industrial modernization seems appealing to tribal leaders as well. You know, in a sense, these two groups find shared interests in their opposition to federal power, coming from very different understandings of, you know, and very different realities of their, you know, of the extent to which federal power hampers them. But they kind of find a, you know, shared agreement that, oh, for kind of Navajo leaders, building power plants will be the first step toward a process leading toward industrial modernity. I mean, this is the heyday of modernization theory. And the kind of ideas of what, you know, what steps a people has to take in order to achieve something called modernity, are assumed to be a kind of linear stage of development process. This, of course, quickly, proves false. Starting by the mid 60s, kind of both Navajo leaders and local Navajo people are very much seeing the kind of negative effects of energy development on their lands, begin seeing few of the benefits, seeing a limited amount of industrial development, a few good jobs. By the 80s and 90s, kind of more of the workforces of these mines and power plants become Navajo. But in the 50s and 60s, they're not. But certainly not the kind of, you know, not the kind of economic development that tribal leaders had hoped for. And at the same time, they're seeing really dire ecological effects, both health effects on people and kind of the destruction, the damage of local spaces that are deeply important to people.
Great. And this is this will all be aggravated by sort of the developments that happen on Navajo land after the hydroelectric dams in the Grand Canyon are scuttled. And so in the chapter six called The Living River, you kind of lay out this contentious fight over whether these dams were going to be built. And it became really a national, if not an international, issue. And you have like the Sierra Club and other environmentalist groups sort of like introducing a novel language of, rights to undeveloped nature. But really tellingly, those rights to a pristine nature, namely tourist locations like the Grand Canyon, had the effect of revving up economic energy development and ecological damage in the Navajo lands. Can you say something about this moment and perhaps why energy development was so much more palatable in a place like the Navajo reservation rather than the Grand Canyon?
Sure. I think one of the really interesting things you see in this battle over kind of a proposal to build dams at either end of the Grand Canyon is you see environmental groups coming up, I think for the first time with a really profound critique of suburban growth. In one of the Sierra Club publishes two really widely distributed and well-known picture books at the time of Kenyan landscapes that are meant to, you know, provide people with a sense of here's the loss. Here's what's lost with the development of hydroelectric dams, of flooding of these canyon landscapes. And, you know, in one of these books, one of the authors writes something like, how much isn't, you know, essentially, how much is enough? Will Phoenix be a better place if it has 3 million people instead of 2 million people? Will Los Angeles be a better place if, you know, it has 15 million people instead of 10 million? Like, to what, you know, what is the end of this kind of growth if it ends up being so kind of profoundly destructive to places that are kind of majestic and special? However, the Sierra Club, because of a set of commitments to protecting national parks, really kind of draws the border of that critique. I mean, that's a very wide-ranging critique. The way they apply it politically, though, is restricted to kind of the borders of Grand Canyon National Park, and to the idea that the ecological life of the park, with the Colorado River flowing through it at its heart, is one of the things that, you know, that makes that place special. They, you know, broadly kind of, they not only kind of ignore nearby spaces on the Navajo Nation, but they actively, in the book at least, promote both coal development and atomic development as, you know, as answers to this, as solutions to the problem of, well, if we don't build these dams, where will the energy come from? David Brower, who is, you know, in many ways the kind of one of the key founders of the contemporary environmental movement, says essentially, why are we building dams when there's all of this nearby coal available and atomic energy is becoming so, is becoming so widely used? So while they launch this critique of growth, they both spatially contain it into discrete landscapes that are, you know, important in a national imagination and to a kind of particularly to a particular set of kind of metropolitan elites, and at the same time they provide or hold out kind of coal and atomic energy as alternatives. So while the critique of growth is launched, there's not a kind of corresponding critique of limiting kind of energy development as a way to to limit growth in some ways. Later on, you know, to their credit, they do come to see the coal mines that are developed as environmental catastrophes and mobilize politically against them. But by the time they mobilize, those projects are already underway with kind of capital invested in the construction of coal-fired power plants to use them. And I think one of the lessons that I drew in kind of research and writing the book is that when capital gets located in place in the form of infrastructure, then the possibilities for political change becomes much more challenging.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because that was literally what I was about to ask you about. You actually write that, you know, once the material aspects of the geography of power came into existence, resistance to development became much more difficult. So basically what I take from that is that you're saying that you know, like the massive inequalities shaped the development of infrastructure, and then the very like fixedness of infrastructure make those inequalities more permanent, or as your former University of Michigan colleague Nathan Connolly would say, more concrete. Can you actually elaborate on this in reference to some of the political debates going on in the Navajo Nation in the 1970s? There were mines or plants that were occupied by militant indigenous actors, and yet the infrastructure, the terms of the infrastructure, were hard, if not impossible, to challenge.
Yeah, and I think that they became hard. Impossible. They became hard. You know, nothing's impossible, mm-hmm. but they became very, very challenging to impede, both because of, the fixity of infrastructure in place that now kind of, capital had taken physical form, right, in the form of power plants, drag shovels, coal mines, and that increasingly the Navajo Nation became, dependent on the revenues, generated from these plants, both in terms of, royalties on coal, which were, wildly unequal. The Navajo Nation received 25 cents per ton of coal that was sold, it was resold to a power plant for $3 a ton. Almost, immediately upon its mining. So they're dramatically unequal revenues, and yet they become, one of the largest, parts of the tribal treasury. And I mean, this is how dependency works, right? An unequal system, nevertheless becomes people become deeply reliant on a deeply unequal system that both exploits them and becomes very difficult to escape. So the conflicts that in the 1970s as kind of further development is proposed, some I think really telling conflicts erupt on the Navajo Nation between tribal leaders who essentially say we need more energy development in order to be able to function like a state, to have power, essentially say to people in local communities, look, the people at Black Mesa have sacrificed for the Navajo Nation. The people in, the people by Four Corners Power Plant have sacrificed for the Navajo Nation. Now, you people living in Burnham, which is a small community in western New Mexico, it's your turn to do your part. And the people in Burnham say, we know people who live near Four Corners. We know people who live at, Black Mesa. We know what those sacrifices have meant. It's meant the destruction of places that are deeply, deeply important to them, with very little benefit coming back, very little benefit that we can see that's come back to them. So these, conflicts erupt that have continued into the present day, between, the tribal government and local activists who say that the tribal government puts itself in front of the interests of Navajo people, and so those kinds of politics become have become a continuing part of both kind of Navajo politics and Indian politics across the American West. I think it's no accident that the largest non Lakota presence at the No Dapl protests were people from the Navajo Nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really taken aback by some of your points about just how contentious or how much the Navajo Nation was debating, you know, like resource management, you know, sovereignty, all these things, and how like we shouldn't be surprised by that, because like they're the ones who are not only producing the energy that, you know, like everyone else is consuming, but they're also like bearing the brunt of the pollution, and so they're like their very positionality in the energy system like makes these you know, these debates a lot more real. So I was wondering if you could just to sort of like sum up our conversation about this book, I was wondering if you could say something about what your history of, you know, mid-20th century electrical systems in the Southwest can tell us about our, you know, contemporary ecological problems, you know, ranging from climate change to the emptying of the oceans or things like that. Like, what does your book tell us about our contemporary moment?
Yeah, that's one of the questions that I've really puzzled with, like with, you know, the way that kind of in electricity as this kind of almost, you know, this component of our daily lives that exists, you know, around us almost all the time. Now, I mean, you know, I wake up because of electricity most days. You know, I use it constantly throughout the day without thinking. I mean, without thinking necessarily where it's coming from. I mean, I've done enough work to know generally what the kind of conditions of my electricity are. But that, like, the fact that here's this presence that has over the past, you know, 60 years, been one of the primary drivers of carbon intensification. And that it's most visible, distant from the people who use it most. I think that's one of the profound developments, infrastructural developments of the past 60 years, and it's one of the most troubling, because the promotion of a kind of unknowing consumption that both has deepened kind of urban-rural inequalities, and has, you know, endangered the planet, and, you know, and continues to, you know, it continues to endanger the planet, and has created patterns of kind of underdevelopment and dependency that means that people in coal producing regions have, you know, seemingly few other options, economic options. You know, this nexus of kind of metropolitan expectation and metropolitan ignorance, I think, is one of the kind of major engines of, you know, of the kind of patterns of thought that go to kind of exacerbate climate change. I think, you know, one of the things that's most hopeful is the way that kind of indigenous activists, you know, in the past decade have really kind of arisen to make the costs of, you know, energy, both on a local level and on a global level, you know, increasingly visible, and the ability to demand notice through, you know, through protest actions, through political organizing, and, you know, through the way that they are at least in part able to kind of, you know, insist that those stories become present on a national level.
Great. Well, I think that's a good place to leave the book. On this show, we always ask our guests what they're working on right now.
Yeah, I'm working right now on a history of Native New York in the first half of the twentieth century. That's part of a broader project that I'm kind of working on about thinking about the indigenous place in North American urban life, across the broad sweep. So I'm co-editing I'm organizing a symposium and co-editing a volume that will begin next year that's tentatively called Indian Cities: Histories of Indigenous Urbanism, that look at the kind of the central role that Native peoples have played both in as urban actors and as subjects of urbanization. And so the New York part of the story looks both at the place of Native people in kind of the cultural life of New York and in the material life in the building of the built environment of the city, the kind of modern, you know, what we think of as the modern skyline of New York is built in large part by steelworkers from Akwesasne steelworkers whose homelands are along the U.S.-Canadian border. So it's a kind of Native history of New York City at the moment of its kind of emergence as the capital of the modern world.
Well, really look forward to that. Thanks again for speaking to me, and thank you to all of our listeners.
Thank you for talking to me.